in order to get back up to conjugation, we need to do a little bit of review from last quarter as far as what is a bond and what is an antibond. Because conjugation is really talking about distributed molecular orbitals in which we represent those orbitals through the combination of a whole series of p orbitals. And when we talked about bonding and antibonding last quarter, we talked about it being the overlap of different orbitals. And you might remember a pi bond. We used two p orbitals in different ways to make the both a pi bond and antibond. Well, now if you end up with a system where multiple p orbitals overlap, what we need to see is what is the effect on the set of molecular orbitals that's formed. So it's just an extension of talking about bonding and antibonding. But knowing that all that was last quarter, I'm guessing that a large number of you wouldn't successfully navigate your way through a bonding and antibonding problem right now if you had to. Would that be a fair assessment? To say it in less flowery language, how many of you actually remember what bonding and antibonding is? That's
kind of is not good enough, so now we've got to go back and review it. What is a bond? And could someone close that back door that all the construction and trucks and freeways distracting? Why does a bond form? Why does a bond form?
Make it more stable.
Which means what? To release energy. A bond is something that happens because energy is released. There's the classic way of describing that, talking about plus charges and minus charges and how far away they are from each other, but that classical view leaves out one really important point, that these charges are not particles, that they really act like waves. And so that any description that we have of bonding or antibonding, if we want to be complete about it, better include something to do with waves. And so let me ask you a follow-up question. Do atomic orbitals exist in a system that has bonds?
No.
Why not?
It becomes hybridized.
Why?
Because bond energy is so different now.
Because the energy is not the same.
But whether or not the energy is the same or different, why is the fact that if I ask if there's atomic orbitals when there are bonds, you don't even have to worry about energy to answer that question? You've got the right answer, but you've answered two different problems. One is that you can solve for the Schrodinger equation, the equation that actually gives you the functions that map out those different orbitals. You can solve those functions if you have one electron only in your atom. If you have multiple electrons, you can still come up with the orbitals, but we can't solve them directly because there are too many variables involved. But there's still atomic orbitals. But if you have a bond, that means you have more than one nucleus around. If you have more than one nucleus around, do you really still have atomic orbitals?
No.
Technically, no. Remember that from last quarter? So the new people, what I'm getting at is that if you think about what s, p, and d, and f orbitals look like, you've got a nucleus in the center here. An s orbital is symmetric around that. A p orbital is symmetric in that it's cut right in the middle where the nucleus is. A d orbital is a flower shape that's still with the nucleus right in the middle. But in other words, all these shapes, all these patterns depend on the fact that you have one nucleus and however many other electrons around it. Well, as soon as you have multiple nuclei, that electron is going to be influenced by more than one nucleus. So that means automatically the shape of the orbital that you get is going to be different. Now, sometimes it's not that different. Sometimes it's close enough that we use atomic orbitals to represent molecular orbitals. And we even do that for bonds. I mean, a bond exists no matter what our description of it is, but we have a way of describing it where we use atomic orbitals to get at bonds. Why? Because it takes an awful lot of math and concept just to understand an atomic orbital. And once you've done all that work,
Do you want to throw all that away? Well, to get the exact right answer, the answer might be yes, but we can estimate what bonds look like by using atomic orbitals. So what I'm doing out loud is kind of reminding myself what we covered last quarter, but trying to condense all that down to a nice summary statement, which I guess I'll attempt it in this way. Atomic orbitals, which we're going to abbreviate AO, describe the possible locations of electrons in a mononuclear system. A follow-up to that thought is that all the shapes of atomic orbitals depend on the presence of only one nucleus and are all symmetric around that nucleus. Molecules have bonds, which are interactions between multiple nuclei. They're favorable, that's why they happen, but they're interactions between multiple nuclei. The shapes of the orbitals involved are automatically different because multiple nuclei are involved. So I don't think this is the way I said it just then, but because multiple nuclei are involved, you can't directly use atomic orbitals to express what's going on in a molecule. I'm going to put in parentheses here the word methane, because this is not a question that you're going to get on an exam, not unless I think that I need to focus enough on review that I include a question like that. Because last quarter when we were talking about this topic, we discussed how methane demonstrates two problems. That if you look at the atomic orbitals in the valence shell of carbon, relative to each other, they all have 90 degree angles. But in methane, you've got 109.5 degree angle. It's a tetrahedron. Similarly, if you look at s and p orbitals of carbon in a polyelectronic, not nuclear, polyelectronic system, where you do have, as Fernandez was talking about, electrons interacting with electrons, orbitals are no longer necessarily equal in energy. So 2s orbital in carbon is a different energy than a 2p orbital. But in methane, you have four energetically equivalent bonds. And so this is where hybridization comes from. Hybridization is a way of combining atomic orbitals in order to create a system of molecular orbitals that match the geometry of the molecule. But that's not quite what bonding is, but that's where this story of methane comes from. Because every quarter in 12A I have a problem where I ask, well, why don't atomic orbitals work? And give me an example of how they don't work. That's methane. Now let me go ahead and say this thing about hybridization, though, because that's one stepping stone leading up to bonding. Hybridization is a process of combining atomic orbitals on the same atom to describe the
the structure of a molecule. So hybridization involves combining atomic orbitals to create effectively new molecular orbitals, or MOs. That match the geometry of the system. I'll put in parentheses here, match Vesper. Because last quarter we reviewed what Vesper theory is, this way of predicting what molecular structure is going to be by simply looking at the number of pairs of electrons and how they would all repel each other. Well, that prediction normally holds true. Then we have to go back and say, okay, how can we make atomic orbitals give us the same answer? And that's what hybridization is. But notice, and I'm going to underline this, and in fact, I'm not going to underline it, I'm going to have to put it in here, that hybridization involves combining atomic orbitals on the same atom to create these hybrids. Bonding can be explained by combining atomic orbitals on different atoms. Explain's actually not the best word. It can be represented by using atomic orbitals on different atoms. Now, at this point, if this was 12A, I could run off and start talking about hydrogen. And then talk about helium and why hydrogen forms and helium doesn't. And then we could talk about oxygen, where we start involving both S and P orbitals. But you all had 12A already. So I'm assuming that you remember that, or if you don't remember that, or you never had that, then you'd want to go back to 12A and review that. I want to have a more focused discussion of just a pi bond, and maybe if we have time, a sigma bond. Because what we're doing is leading up to conjugation, which is where you can have multiple p orbitals overlap with each other. So this is a more focused discussion than what we had in 12A. Before I move on to start easing us into a pi bond and a pi antibond, any questions up to this point? All right, so I guess we better do a sigma bond just to have done one so we know how to model a sigma bond. But instead of just doing plain old hydrogen, let's look at a bond in something like methane. And this will be another chance for me to review for the newer students these SMOG diagrams, structural molecular orbital graphs. That we used last quarter to show what types of orbitals are present on a molecule. Methane, what's the hybridization of carbon and methane? Which newer students, if you can't answer for any atom on any molecule, what is the hybridization, then you need to review that and come to office hours and ask for help on that, because that's a fundamental skill that everyone needs to have. Everyone that is returning, if you forgot how to do it, or you never really did get it, you just crossed your fingers and hope you got it right on each exam, then you better again come back and make sure that you ask me to run through it with you, because you need to know it, because we're going to do SMOG diagrams. So, in fact, I better make this a formalized review. Structural molecular orbital graphs. Did I actually write a definition this quarter of what this is? No. A graphical depiction of the types
orbitals. Present in a molecule, ignoring sign of the wave function. Because you might recall when you first learned what a p orbital was, if you got it taught to you properly, you know that it's shaded two different ways, one half of the p orbital versus the other. And that's because mathematically, one half is a negative sign of the function that represents it, while the other half's a positive. But we don't show this in smog diagrams. Now that I've warned you about that, we're going to go back, and we will be showing sign in a minute when we do bonding diagrams. So smog diagrams you need to know, but we're going to be using two sets of diagrams this quarter. The smog to just see the structure, but then a bonding diagram to show the type of interactions that are going on. So a smog diagram for methane would look pretty simple. Now, one thing for the newer students is that a hybrid orbital technically has a node. So this, for the moment, is a drawing that does show wave function sign. And we won't be reviewing now how to make hybrids. I'm just showing you that when I represent hybrids, I'm going to simplify. Because that's not really drawn quite correctly. One half, or one segment, one lobe, we call it, of that hybrid orbital is much larger than the other. And there's enough difference where I simplify and just write one of the lobes. So if I'm drawing methane, I'm going to draw the four sp3 orbitals. And purple is the color that I used last quarter always to represent an sp3 hybrid. Attached to each one of those is an s orbital. And so for methane, it's a pretty simple diagram. There's one key point here that notice that the sp3 orbital is written as a distinct orbital from the s orbital. In other words, it's not just one blob that connects the two. But in reality, it is just a blob of electron density that's there. In methane, there is no sp3 orbital or s orbital. It's four sigma bonds. But this is the way that the picture is drawn so that we can understand the structure. But I just want to point that out again. This is not what it really is. This is our way to represent it. But now let's focus on how would we represent that sigma bond that's here. Well, now let's go ahead and do this. It's a little more complicated than hydrogen, but let's tackle that. Because here's one of the complications. In hydrogen, when we learned about making sigma bonds, we had two orbitals that were equal in energy, one hydrogen connecting with another. We now have an sp3 orbital from carbon bonding with a s orbital from hydrogen. Now, there's going to be differences in those orbital energies automatically because there's a different number of nuclei or a different number of protons in carbon versus hydrogen. But ignoring that, why do you think it is that an s orbital in general is lower than sp3 in energy? Because it's what? It's closer to the nucleus. Why is that true? Or why would the sp3 be further from the nucleus? Because it has more what's called p character. So if you remember this phrase character that we used
last quarter when describing the acidity of alkanes, alkenes versus alkynes. We also used an argument there about how the type of hybrid present would influence how acidic the compound is. And the reasoning there was that in an alkyne, if a hydrogen came off an alkyne, a negative charge is going into an sp orbital. Sp is only 50% p. P is higher than s. But that's better than if you have an sp2 orbital, which is only a third s, versus an sp3 orbital, which is only 25% s. So the less s there is, the higher energy it is, which is how we get to the same situation here. But they are close enough in energy that they're going to still overlap with each other. And automatically, there are two orbitals created when two nuclei interact.
One is favorable, a lower energy than either orbital to begin with. The other one is higher in energy. Now I'm going to go ahead and label these as sigma and sigma star. The star means antibond. And hopefully you could go back and figure out that, yes, there'd only be one electron in either of the individual orbitals that we use to make up the bond. If you can't figure that out, then remember, a bond's only two electrons. So either both came from one atom, or one came from each. And I'm just choosing to show it as one coming from each. There's some justification for that, because in methane, carbon had four valence electrons, hydrogen had one. So take one of each of the valence electrons from carbon, it can make one of each of the sigma bonds that forms. Well, things roll downhill, and so the two electrons go into that bonding orbital. None of them go into the antibonding orbital, which is why we say there's a bond. One of the confusing things about antibonds that always comes up is, well, wait, if that antibond is there, then how can the molecule exist? Because if you have an antibond, doesn't that destabilize the system? No. Because you always have bonds and antibonds, it's how many electrons are in them. Because it's the electrons that are the bond or the antibond. Otherwise, you just have a space called an orbital. So the fact that we actually have electrons in the sigma bond is why the bond is there, is why the molecule forms. If we put electrons into the antibond, that's when the bond breaks. Which, to help connect this back to something we did this quarter, remember that although you're not responsible for knowing the mechanism of forming a Grignard reagent, we did talk, or I did mention about how the first step of that is to put electron into an antibonding orbital. And we could see here that if all we had is a sigma bond, then that's exactly the only place electrons could go, in a sigma star orbital. But this is not the full picture, literally, because on top of being able to write an orbital energy diagram, you need to know what does a bond look like. And this is the part that is probably the most confusing aspect of molecular orbital theory, is that we do the following. We say, all right, there is an sp3 orbital, which if I'm doing a full orbital diagram, I need to draw both the lobes. And there's an s orbital. Well, what if the large lobe of the sp3 hybrid is the same sign as the s orbital? Well, two functions that have the same sign add together. Let me make this more clear by showing the position of the nuclei involved. We could instead imagine a situation where the sp3's larger lobe is opposite in sign to the s orbital, which again, just using this red to show where the nuclei, are located, we're going to end up with a situation like this. Where the point at which the sp3 and the s orbital would overlap each other, they cancel each other out. Which means there'd be no electrons there, which means that's, yet again, a node. So notice that for one case, we end up with electrons between nuclei, which in super scientific notation I'll represent like this. Versus the cancellation where there's no electron density that I'll represent like that. Now, that might get a few smiles or frowns, but there's a reason I'm going to use that notation, and you'll see that momentarily. But this is the way we represent the bond. Does this really happen? No, because those atomic orbitals don't exist if you're in a molecule. But the whole point of all this story is to say, here's our model for making a bond. Now, this doesn't look like the hydrogen bond and antibond because we're using different orbitals. But this is also to highlight the fact that it doesn't just have to be between two hydrogens to make a bond, to make a sigma bond. It can be any kind of hybrid and any other kind of orbital as long as they touch head to head, that there's one line between the two nuclei that bond lies along. That's a sigma bond. Questions before I move to a pi bond? Yeah?
In the energy diagram,
yeah.
Did it just describe the CH bond? Or?
Because we chose to only describe the CH bond. Right. And when you have multiple bonds, you would say which one you're looking at. Because how would you compare all these different orbitals with each other in the first place? So normally we just focus on one bond. Now there is another approach that takes a more molecular view beyond the level of this course. Now let's move to a pi bond, and I'll barely have time to show you where we're going next.
So in a carbon-carbon pi bond, it's exactly these two interactions that we're looking at, the way of modeling what's going on. Oops. Sorry. Wrong picture. There we go. So again, we allow these things to overlap, and we end up with shapes that would look something like this to stylize it. Now notice that again, on the lower case, we end up with electrons between nuclei. Here we have no electrons between, which is not favorable. If we were to draw an orbital energy diagram, here's what it would look like. We start with two p orbitals, each of which, if it's just a bond, have one electron in it. There's a favorable and unfavorable overlap that's caused because you have two nuclei. The fact that you have these two possibilities comes from the nuclei both interacting with each other and the electron. The lower energy case is a pi bond, and picture-wise corresponds to what we have over the left. Again, with electrons being between the nuclei, which is why it's lower in energy in the first place. Now, those of you from last quarter might remember a question where I asked you to explain why is a bond lower in energy, and you might remember me getting on your case for giving me an answer that basically says a bond is lower in energy because it's lower in energy. Meaning you look at the diagram, you see that the bond is lower, and you say it's lower. But yes, the question is, why is it lower? And it's not just because it's lower on this diagram, it's because electrons end up between nuclei. Plus and minus charge come closer together, which releases energy.
And the antibond, if you're pushing electrons away from the middle between the two nuclei, then that's unfavorable. That's why it's higher in energy. And that's a pi star. And I think we even did a little bit of this example, but this is firmly in 12B material now, which is, what do we do with a case like this? Because if we drew a smog diagram, not a bonding diagram, but a smog diagram, what would it look like? The following. You have sp2 hybridization on all three of the carbons. And for the newer people, you notice that because of the number of years I've been doing this, when I'm drawing my sp2 hybrids, I do it in such a way where I'm predicting or anticipating that I'm going to be drawing p orbitals in. And I try to make sure that my sp2s, I don't draw in such a way that they would overlap on top of my p's. Blue, by the way, is the color that I kept using last quarter for sp2. Then don't forget the hydrogens, which are s orbitals, and then since this is a smog diagram and I'm not showing sine, I'm going to fill the whole p orbital in. But here's the problem. Which of the p orbitals are going to form that double bond that's shown in the diagram? I heard some of my classic programmed answers. I heard yes, I heard no, and I had neither. Why are they giving me all these strange answers like yes and no? Because my dad, when I was young, used to always do this type of thing. If I'd say, Dad, are we going to go there today or tomorrow? He said, yes. Because we're going to go today or we're going to go tomorrow. So when I asked, are we going to go today or tomorrow? Well, in parentheses, if that's an or statement, the answer is yes. So my question of which of the orbitals is going to actually overlap with this, the answer is yes, because all three of the p orbitals overlap. That's what conjugation is. That's what resonance is. But what do we do to represent that using atomic orbitals? Well, there's a couple of principles that you got to learn, which is the number of molecular orbitals generated in what's called a pi system, that's where multiple p orbitals overlap, is equal to the number of p orbitals used to represent the system. And because of where it is and because of the time, no, actually, I better go ahead and show this. But I'm going to need a volunteer. Volunteer? Tyler? There we go. See, he knows what I'm going to do. Because you know I can't go a quarter without doing this demonstration, right? But now that I got someone holding it, then hopefully the... Hopefully neither you nor the phone will get hurt in this demonstration. Yes. So the point of this is, what is a quantized energy system, which is really the point of this wave demonstration. You're holding that tight, right? Because this is the way that we're going to represent these different pi systems. Think about the bonding picture I just had here for a simple full bond. A simple pi bond. One way we could go back and view these pi bonds is to say, well, here's the lowest energy function, and here's one higher function, which you notice that the bottom function never crosses this axis in between the two. It's as if we made the two p orbitals like the boundaries within which this wave, this electron, can exist. Well, if we go up one level of energy, that's the point of this demonstration, that if you have some kind of system in which the endpoints are fixed,
The lowest energy level possible is one in which the function spans the two points without a node in between. But if you go up one level of energy, then you've got a node there. And you notice the two halves, if you were able to take a stop frame of this, one would be pointed the opposite direction of the other. But in the middle, there's nothing. Well, remember that if electrons are waves, and the waves, the way we interpret it is that their probability of an electron being somewhere, well, if the wave is always zero, you never have an electron there. That's how we end up with an antibond. But what happens if we end up with a system where there's three nuclei? Well, then you end up with a case where you could have a third energy wave, where there's now two nodes. And notice that those nodes are symmetrically spaced, where you divide the space evenly into thirds. You get it. Do I have to do more? But remember, the whole point of that is to show you that you can use a wave equation to match or to represent the p orbital representation. Sorry, too many. Let me draw what I'm trying to say, actually, because here's the point. That if you have three p orbitals, you have three molecular orbitals that you generate, which to superimpose, here's a function that spans with one node, spans with two nodes. If we make the three nuclei to be evenly spaced, as they would be, then if we were to fill in the shading to match that wave that we superimposed, you'd shade them all the same way. And that would put electrons between all the nuclei. That would be the lowest energy possible, and that's why I wrote it at the bottom here. The opposite case, up at top. Notice that you have nodes that are in between. And in fact, this is the worst possible case, where between each atom there's a node. So if we wanted to fill in the sign of the wave function that would give us the same looking creature, well, each one's going to be opposite the other. Well, that means there's no electrons between nuclei. That's the worst possible energy. So that's why it's written up above. It's highest in energy. What about that middle orbital? You notice the node passes right through where one of the atoms would be. Well, that means that in the representation of the wave function, we don't use that orbital. Now, this every year someone says, but wait, how can an orbital just disappear? They all disappeared because it's a bond, so none of those atomic orbitals exist. So don't worry about the poor atomic orbital. Worry about how we use it to represent this system. So we're only going to use the orbitals at one end or another. And there's a sign flip that happens because there's one node. So the phone cord demonstration was to show you in a physical example of going from 0 to 1 to 2 nodes. Energetically, what do we get? We get a bond where electrons are between all atoms. We get an antibond. But then we also get a non-bond, which means it's the same energy as if nothing happened in the first place. If you think about it, if this really was a molecular orbital whose general shape could be represented by this overlaid function, and if that function really passes through zero at this point, then it's as if the two other portions of this orbital don't have any interaction with each other at all, that electrons aren't really between anything. It's neither an increase nor decrease in energy. That's a non-bond. Well, we're going to go on Wednesday with what time we have after doing the synthesis problems is see a 4p orbital system and see if we can start seeing some generalization as to how these molecular orbitals are represented.